Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, the first meeting of the Conference Committee on House File 1077, the Housing Finance and Policy Bill, will come to order. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Representative Houseman.
Present.
Houseman present. Representative Howard. Representative Howard. Representative Egbadje.
Present.
Egbadje present. Representative Ryer.
Present.
Ryer present. Representative Tice. Representative Tice.
Present.
Tice present. Senator Dreheim.
Present.
Dreheim present. Senator Duckworth. Senator Duckworth. Senator Dames.
Present.
Dames present. Senator Pratt. Pratt excused. And Senator Dietzick.
Present.
Dietzick present. And then Representative Howard.
Present.
Howard present. Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you. Welcome to everyone. I look forward to working to get towards a strong bill. I hope it is a fast process. Senator Dreheim and I just both already shared that desire. A strong bill that reflects the housing needs across Minnesota and across the spectrum of housing needs. I encourage any of you to reach out to me with questions or thoughts on the committee at any time. We'll first have, I think we'll... we'll have members introduce themselves. I think it would be helpful because we have some new people just to let us know what area of the state you represent. We'll start with the Senate, Senator Dreheim, Chair Dreheim.
Thank you. Rich Dreheim, I represent most of the Seward County, part of Scott County, and part of Rice County. The Scott County portion is the lower portion of Scott County. And Senator Pratt, who's on a different conference committee right now, who is also on our conference committee, represents the majority of Scott County. So thank you.
Is Senator Duckworth on? Perhaps not yet. Senator Dietzick.
Hi, everybody. My name is Terry Dietzick, and I have the honor and privilege to represent East Minneapolis. So I have the Minneapolis campus of the U of M, both the East Bank and West Bank campus, and then I have the Augsburg College campus and parts of Cedar Riverside and Seward. Thanks.
Thank you. And Representative Howard.
Thanks, Chair Houseman. Representative Mike Howard, I represent District 50A, which includes East and Southwest Ridgefield, as well as East Bloomington.
Representative Tice. Are we?
Oh my goodness. Oh,
there you are.
So I'm Representative Tama Tice. I am in the St. Cloud area. I represent District 14A, which is St. Cloud Bay Park, St. Augusta. And been in the housing industry since I was, 25. And I'm not 25 anymore.
Welcome. Representative Egbadje.
Thank you so much, Chair Houseman. My name is Esther Egbadje. I represent House District 59B, which covers the areas of downtown Minneapolis and parts of the north side, including Near North, Willard Hay, Bryn Mawr, and Harrison. So thank you guys.
And Representative Ryer.
Hello, Liz Ryer. I represent the East Side of Eagan, House District 51B.
And did Senator Dames come in yet? Oh, there he is. Or was it Duckworth? I think Duckworth was the one who wasn't here earlier. Did we get everyone?
Senator Dames hasn't gone yet either.
Okay, Senator Dames.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gary Dames represents Senate District 16, which is six counties in southwest Minnesota. I have Brown County, Redwood County, Lyon County, Yellow Medicine, Lacaparo, and part of Renville.
And did we miss anybody? We got everybody. So we are first going to have a House and Senate fiscal staff walk through the House File 1077 joint spreadsheet. Mr. Savory and Mr. Mueller, please proceed with your presentations. I'm assuming you've got yourselves organized to know who is going first.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the tape. My name is Ken Savory, House Fiscal Staff. We'll be walking through the spreadsheet. I'll be taking the House portion, and Mr. Mueller will be discussing the Senate portion. Just a few housekeeping items. I'll speak to this kind of the layout of the spreadsheet. You'll see a variety of columns in the spreadsheet from left to right. And starting with columns D and E are biennial columns representing the forecast base from the February forecast. Then proceeding to the right, columns F, G, H, and I are columns for the governor. And then columns J, K, L, and M are columns representing the Senate. And the remaining columns N, O, P, Q, and R are columns representing the House positions. I think for the presentation, we'll go over the change items, i.e. the items that were changed in various positions in the House and Senate bills. And I'll start with those change items beginning on line 30 and proceeding all the way down through line 47. So starting on line 32, the House increases the challenge program by $6 million one time in FY22-23. Line 33 is an increase to the Home Ownership Assistance Fund by $3.5 million one time in FY22-23. Line 34 is an increase to the Rental Assistance for Mobile Students, or the Homework Starts with Home program. That's a $1 million increase to the base in FY22-23, and then the same increase in FY24-25. Line 35 is an increase to the Workforce Home Ownership Program of $3.5 million in FY22-23, and then the increase of $1 million in FY24-25. Line 36 is an increase to the Manufactured Home Park Infrastructure Grants. That's a $2 million one-time increase in FY22 and 23. Line 37 is an increase to the Home Ownership Education Counseling and Training Program, or HECAT. That's a $500,000 increase in FY22-23. Line 38 is an increase to the Rental Assistance for the Mentally Ill, or the Bridges Program. That's a $1.5 million increase in FY22-23. And the identical increase in FY24-25. Skipping down a few lines is the next change item for the House, which is on line 41. And that is an increase to the Local Housing Trust Fund grants. That's a $3 million increase in FY22-23. The next is on line 42, which is the Natural Occurring Affordable Housing Preservation, which is a $6,501,000 increase in FY22-23. Line 43 is an appropriation to the Lead Safe Homes Grants Program. That's a $2 million increase in FY22-23 and a $1.5 million increase in FY24-25. Line 44 is an increase to the Shelter Provider Task Force. That's $455,000 in FY22-23. And then finally on line 45 is an appropriation to the Supreme Court. In all told on line 48 are the total for the change items, which is $26 million in the first year, $4 million in the second year, for a total of $30 million above base in FY22-23. And then additionally, going over to the next column, it's a $5 million increase above the base tails in FY24-25. Just a couple other items remaining. Line 57 and 61 are change items related to House File 203, which changed some items in the Minnesota Bond Allocation Act that allowed for refunds due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And so those are some revenue changes there to the Special Revenue Fund and the Housing Development Fund. Additionally, between the columns O, P, and Q, you'll see a large footnote noting that the Supreme Court appropriation is in response to the fiscal note for House File 12. That is the off-ramp for rental stabilization. And then, Madam Chair, I believe that concludes the House items, and I'll turn it over to Mr. Mueller to cover the Senate items.
Mr. Mueller, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Mueller. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Housing Finance Committee, and I will be working off of columns J, K, and L off this spreadsheet. And we'll just, again, I'll just go with the change items, but I will note the Senate came in with a working off the base budget of $57.798 million per year. So any of the changes within the Senate's proposal had to be a reallocation of that base budget. So, and also note that all the change items in the Senate side continue on into the tails. So the first change item is line 32, the challenge program. The Senate reduced that amount by $1 million per year or $2 million for the biennium, and that continues on in the tails. On line 35, the workforce home ownership program, the Senate added $1.6 million per year or $3.2 million for the biennium. Line 36, the manufactured home park infrastructure grants, the Senate added $750,000 per year or $1.5 million for the biennium. And then under HECAT, or the Home Ownership Education Counseling and Training, the Senate added $150,000 per year to that program. And then there's some additional rider language that allocates $500,000 per year of the total HECAT appropriation for a specific purpose. And when we get to the language, I'll point that out. For bridges, the Senate did not add any additional general fund money for that, but I will note that the Senate in the appropriation article has some language allocating an additional $250,000 per year of federal resources, if they are available for the bridges program. Under housing rehabilitation, line 39, the Senate has the same reduction that the governor had of $1 million per year or $2 million for the biennium. And then on line 46, the Build Wealth Minnesota, $500,000 per year. That is not a specific appropriation anymore, but Build Wealth would be eligible now under the HECAT appropriation. Then the one other item I'll note is back up on line 22, the Senate has an additional carve out under the capacity building grants for the open access mail voicemail program of $85,000 per year. That's one where they're currently funded out of that pool, but the Senate named them along with the homeless management information system that was already in the base, and it's in both the House and Senate bill. So that's it for the Senate general fund appropriation changes that are on the spreadsheet. And I'll answer any questions if there are any.
Questions from members? I'm not seeing any hands, Mr. Worth. Am I missing anyone? Questions on the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, there are no questions at this time.
Then we'll have our walkthrough of the housing side-by-side led by House and Senate nonpartisan staff, House Research and Senate Counsel. If you would please introduce yourselves and proceed with your presentation. We'll probably pause for questions at the conclusion of each article. Ms. Mullen, who's going first?
Madam Chair, this is Chelsea Griffin with House Research. So for the record, again, Chelsea Griffin, House Research, I will actually be beginning the walkthrough of the side-by-side starting on page R10. So this is starting with the language of Article 2 in both the House and the Senate. Okay. Section 1 of the House and Section 9 the Senate language eliminates the limitation on rehabilitation loans that prohibits such a loan to be made in excess of 110% of a property's market value. The difference in the language here is that the House has an effective date of August 1st, 2021, and the Senate has an effective date of July 1st, 2021. Section 2 of the House and Section 10 of the Senate, starting on page R11, authorizes MHFA to make rehabilitation loans for the purpose of replacing manufactured homes. And the maximum loan amount is also increased in each bill. The difference is here, the maximum loan amount is different. So the House has $35,000, the Senate has $40,000, and the effective dates are again different. The House has an effective date of August 1st, and the Senate July 1st, 2021. Sections 3, 4, and 5 of the House language is House only language. Section 3, beginning on page R12 of the side-by-side, requires MHFA to impose renter income restrictions on multifamily rental housing developments and a 30-year covenant as a condition of agency financing. Section 4 establishes a Lead Safe Homes grant program in MHFA to make grants to provide lead testing and lead hazard reduction in rental housing. And Section 5 on page R13 clarifies that the debt ceiling relates to general obligation bonds and notes. Section 6 of the House and Section 15 of the Senate amends housing infrastructure bond definitions. The House language eliminates financing of construction or rehabilitation of single-family houses that qualify for certain mortgage financing from the definition of housing infrastructure bonds, and the Senate does not have a similar change. The Section 7 of the House and Section 16 of the Senate, beginning on page R14, amends authorized purposes for which housing infrastructure bonds can be used. The House adds financing of construction, acquisition, and rehabilitation of permanent affordable housing for households at or below 50% of area median income, and also has a requirement that MHFA give priority to projects that provide housing to households at or below 30% of area median income. Section 8 of the House language, or actually sections 8, 9, and 10, this is House only language. This starts on page R16 of the side-by-side. Section 8 increases the maximum grant or loan amount for workforce housing projects to 50% of rental housing development project costs. Section 9 establishes a new naturally occurring affordable housing program in MHFA to support and preserve such housing. And then on page R17, if Section 10, this establishes a task force on shelter resident provider practices. Chairs and members of the conference committee, that I am going to turn the next few provisions over to Mr. Stang with Senate Counsel.
Mr. Stang, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the conference, thank you and good morning. Chris Stang, Senate Counsel. The next few sections, starting on page R22, are Senate only provisions. Section 6 provides exemption for 1 and 2 family dwellings and townhouses from window fall prevention regulation when the window is as described here. I believe that language was worked out with the Department of Labor and Industry. Section 7 encourages municipalities to enact public policies to facilitate the development of unsubsidized affordable housing in their comprehensive municipal plan. Section 8 limits the use of planned unit development agreements. The section does several things. A municipality is not allowed to use a planned unit development agreement if the residential housing development otherwise complies with city zoning. Elements of the agreement cannot exceed what's already found in the state building code, and there's further a limitation on aesthetic mandates. A municipality cannot require those if those are not required by the state building code. Section 13 requires the Housing Finance Agency to award points in their decision making for all programs based in part on how quickly a project can be constructed. Section 23 requires the agency to develop and implement a program that offers mortgage financing and down payment assistance for purchasers of eligible manufactured homes. I believe there's a program out in New Hampshire in terms of at least one state that's doing this, and the Senate wants the agency to do the same. Section 24 deals with rent control. And current law is that rent control cannot be implemented by a city unless by vote of in a general election. And this section, in conjunction with the repealer in Section 28, gets rid of the ability to do it by an election. So basically, in this state, you couldn't impose rent control. Sections 25 and 26 deal with housing pool allocation. Bonds. This is done by the Commissioner of Management and Budget. And currently, if projects are at the same priority level and there's a tie, they allocate them bonding authority randomly. And the Senate bill requires that be done a tiebreaker for projects that have a lower cost per square foot instead of randomly. So that takes us all the way to page R30, and now we're back with some overlap with the House. Article 3 on the House side there, Section 1 on the Senate side adds federally recognized American Indian tribes and tribal housing corporations to the entities who may receive grants for affordable housing in natural disaster areas. That language is the same. Section 2 there on the House side, 11 on the Senate side, authorizes the agency to provide support to increase the capacity of entities to meet housing needs in the state. That's identical. Section 3, I'm moving on to page R31 now. Section 3 on the House side, Section 12 on the Senate side, eliminate a requirement under the Family Homeless Prevention Program that a nonprofit have a sponsoring resolution from all county boards located in their operating jurisdiction. The difference between the two is the Senate makes that effective immediately. The House effective date is August 1st. Section 4 allows counties to be eligible for homeownership development grants under the Workforce and Affordable Home Ownership Development Program. There's a difference in effective date there. Senate has July 1. House has August 1st. The next few sections are amendments to the workforce housing program. House and Senate match up on some things, but not on others. One thing these sections do is expand the scope of the program to add federally recognized tribal reservations to the list of eligible project areas for purposes of this program. The Senate and House match up on that. The Senate has a number of changes in here which expand the scope of the program to include homeowners or owner-occupied property. The reason that was done was really to match up with a rider that's been carried for several cycles up in the appropriations article, which currently allows this program to be owner-occupied properties, and that's really kind of contrary to the statutory language. So the Senate included some provisions to hopefully match up with that. There's some differences in effective dates. The Senate has July 1st again, the House August 1st. You've seen that a number of times as we've discussed this. I think the Senate wanted to match up with a fiscal year on some of these. That's kind of the reason for that difference. Section 22 on page R33 of the on the Senate side also added a subdivision related to change in project scope. And that provides when a contingency is provided in a grant award, changes made to the project by the developer shall not be considered a change in project scope if they meet the specified conditions here. And the grant must therefore be awarded. Okay, so I'm down to Article 3 on page R33 on the Senate side, the Senate language on the eviction moratorium phase out. This language also passed in Senate file 1470 two or three weeks ago. On a 46-21 vote, it does a number of things. Section 1 says in the future, emergency orders by the governor related to eviction moratoriums and basically landlord-tenant law cannot exceed 30 days unless both houses of the legislature approve it. So that's what Section 1 basically does. Section 2 makes the current executive order that relates to this subject, Executive Order 2079, void and of no force and effect. And then Section 3 kind of sets forth the timing, if you will, on the phase out. And the main points there are from and after 30 days after enactment, eviction actions would be allowed for material violations of the lease other than non-payment of rent. And from and after 60 days after enactment, eviction actions are allowed for those with outstanding rent, but who are ineligible for rental assistance under the COVID-19 Emergency Rental Assistance Program. An exception to that, or notwithstanding that, if a tenant is eligible for assistance under the Emergency Assistance Program and refuses to apply for it, a landlord may file an eviction action in that circumstance. This whole section expires 90 days after enactment, so then you're back to essentially pre-pandemic law on this issue. Or potentially if the federal government continues to extend their eviction moratorium, that could also be in play at that time as well. Section 4 here is notwithstanding any of the foregoing, as long as a tenant has a pending application for COVID-19 emergency rental assistance, they cannot be evicted up until June 1st, 2022. So that takes us to the top of R37, and I would turn it back over to Ms. Griffin at this point.
Senator Dietzick, you had a question earlier. Do you still have?
Nope, I think I figured it out. Thank you.
Okay. So we're back to Ms. Mullen?
Madam Chair, it's actually me, Chelsea Griffin.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Yes.
Ms. Griffin.
Picking up, I'll be starting with the Article 4 language for the House and the provisions that are being compared with the Senate are from Article 2, the Senate language. So Section 1 of the House and Section 4 of the Senate, this eliminates language referencing family income requirements for purposes of community land trust and a property tax statute. The difference here is that the Senate has a cross-reference to where the income limits live in the statute. Moving on to page R37, Section 2 of the House and Section 14 of the Senate, this clarifies the income limitations for community land trusts. This language is the same. And then finally, Article 5 of the House language, this is House-only language. Section 1 clarifies that fees collected by MMB under the Minnesota Bond Allocation Act must be deposited in a separate account in the Special Revenue Fund. And Section 2 requires a refund of the application deposit money to issuers that returned all of their bonding authority allocation from the 2020 housing pool to avoid a double bond fee due to the circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Madam Chair, with that, I will turn it over to Mary Mullen from House Research.
Ms. Mullen, welcome.
Hi, Chair and members. This is Mary Mullen from the House Research Department. I'm going to be starting on R38. Which is a section labeled Article 6. I would note that this article is going to be House-only provisions. Starting on R38, Sections 1 and 2 deal with public accommodations. This is a service animal bill, and this bill removes the requirement that a service dog has to have identification and clarifies that it can be unfair discriminatory practice if a landlord requires them to be wearing the identification. Section 3 at the bottom of R38 deals with discretionary expungements, and it provides new guidelines on when the court can order a discretionary expungement and an eviction action. On R39, Section 4 deals with mandatory expungements, and it provides additional situations where the court must grant a mandatory expungement. Section 5, labeled Section 5, is a technical change to the definition of the term evict in Chapter 504B. Section 6 relates to back to the support animal bill, and it provides definitions, and it allows a landlord to request supporting documents on whether a tenant has a disability and needs a reasonable accommodation for a service animal. And it also provides that it's illegal to misrepresent an animal as a service animal. Section 7 is on R41. It prohibits a landlord from, it prohibits a tenant from being charged for more than the prorated amount of rent for the last month of rent if the lease requires a tenant to move out before the last day of the month. Section 8 is underneath that, and it prohibits a landlord from imposing an ongoing fee that doesn't relate to a service provided by a landlord, and it imposes a penalty for violating that section. The next section is Section 9, and it removes a provision from existing law that allows a tenant at will to be terminated with 14 days notice. This is in this is specifically for tenancies at will, which are often leases that have no written lease. At the top of R42 is Section 10. It prohibits a landlord from requiring a tenant to sign a new lease until 4 months have passed when an existing lease is 10 months or longer. Section 11 under that requires a landlord to provide heat in a residential tenancy at a minimum temperature of 68 degrees from October 1 to April 30th. At the bottom of R42, Sections 12 and 13 relate to when a landlord can enter a tenancy, and it restricts the landlord to entry between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., requires a 24-hour notice, and it changes the penalties that apply in those situations where a landlord violates that provision.
Before we get too far ahead, Representative Howard has a question, and maybe it relates to something you just passed by. Representative Howard.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just had a quick question about the support service animal provisions, which I think were brought to us by the MHFA, and is that in both bills, or is that just in the House bill? I guess knowing that had been brought to us by landlords and felt like it was kind of consensus language, I was wondering if that was something that was in both bills, and curious if what the conversation was in the Senate on that one.
Senator Dietzick, were you wanting to respond to that particular point?
I believe that the Senator Duckworth bill, and I don't know if he's on or Mr. Stang knows, but I believe that is a part of that is a Duckworth bill that is up on the floor on Wednesday, and tentatively up on the floor on Wednesday. And I do believe it is, I know legal aid and a whole bunch of different entities, including I believe the landlords were working on it. And I see Senator Graham, I think, was shaking his head. So
sounds like it. Representative Howard, did that answer your question?
Yes, that's helpful. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, on the top of R42, that was Section 10. I think we're on to top of R43. That's labeled Section 13, and it changes the penalty for a landlord who enters the apartment without proper notice. Section 14 provides that a tenant screening report needs to be sent with the most updated information within 24 hours of the request, and that it cannot report on eviction cases where the tenant was not actually evicted from the unit. At the top of R44, this is a section that allows tenant to recover damages, costs, and attorney's fees if there's a violation of the tenant screening report requirements and statute. This next section, termination of lease upon infirmity of tenant, it provides a list of health situations that allow a tenant to terminate their lease early. Section 17 on R46 requires a court-appointed attorney in a housing eviction case for a public housing tenant. And then this section also provides the qualifications and compensation for those attorneys. Sections 18 and 19 require a notice, both for the complaint and summons, in a eviction for the non-payment of rent. And the notice has to go out 14 days before the eviction action is brought, and it has to provide the amount that's due and also where a tenant can get assistance to pay for the rent and legal assistance for the case. On R49, this section allows a tenant to answer a complaint orally instead of filing an answer, and it provides a number of ways the court can move forward on an eviction action. On R50, this is a amends a section that allows the court to enforce settlement agreements in housing court cases, and it provides when the court would schedule a hearing and what documents would be filed in order to do that. The section labeled 22 allows the court to provide the same relief in rent abatement cases in an action. R52, you'll see a section 23. It allows a tenant in eviction action to appeal an order denying a motion to vacate judgment in the same manner as in any other civil action. This is common in other civil actions, but they're putting it in 504B. Section 24 provides a requirement for the court forms on summons and writs of recovery and eviction actions. Section 25 removes a reference to a section that is being repealed in this bill. Section 26, same thing, removes a reference to a section that's being repealed in the bill. Section 27 removes a reference to a section that's being repealed by the bill. Section 28 allows an unlawful exclusion case where a tenant's been locked out to be brought for the same filing fee as a conciliation court case. So it allows the tenant to get into court for the conciliation court fee. Section 29 specifies the type of incident that allows a tenant to petition for emergency repairs in a residential rental unit. Section 30 allows a tenant to petition for emergency relief to fix an emergency repair and allows the court to order the landlord to immediately remedy that violation. It requires the court to provide notice on the hearing for an ex parte petition as soon as practicable. Section 31 allows the court to charge the conciliation court filing fee for those emergency repair petitions as well. Section 32 repeals an existing statute governing continuances in housing eviction cases and special appeals proceedings. And then Section 33 provides effective dates for a number of the tenants' rights provisions in that whole article. So I'm going to move on to manufactured housing next. This starts on R55. The first three sections are the same in the House and the Senate bill. So I'll walk through those. You'll see on the House side, it's labeled Section 1, and on the Senate side, it's labeled Section 2. This first section provides a process to affix a manufactured home to real property when the manufactured home park that it's in is a nonprofit cooperative. The process is similar to the process to affix a home to real property when it's not in a manufactured home park. So it's creating a new process for affixing property when they're in those home park cooperatives. On R60, again, these sections are nearly identical in the House and Senate. And this repeals, you'll see later, a repealer that repeals the existing process to affix a manufactured home as an improvement to real property. And it just replaces it. This is updating it. It allows the improvement to real property, but it removes the requirement that the entire year's taxes be paid on the property in order to do that, because the property taxes didn't always need to be paid depending on when that process was going through. And then the last section that goes with those earlier two are clarifying changes relating to affixing a manufactured home to real property. On R65, this is a house-only provision. It's titled Opportunity to Purchase, and it provides a list of, it provides that the representative of the residents of a manufactured home park can submit an offer within 60 days of the notice that the park owner is considering selling, or and it provides a number of things that the park owner needs to do prior to accepting an offer and considering the representatives of the manufactured home park in considering an offer made by them to purchase it, to allow it to become a home park cooperative. Section 5 is labeled on the house side, is the same for both the House and the Senate. It directs the reviser to update statutory citations in the new process for affixing a manufactured home to real property. So it would go through the statutes and correct all the references for the new section. And then there's two repealers on the House side and one on the Senate side. And on the House side, there's a repealer related to the opportunity to purchase bill. And it would repeal the section that currently deals with that in statute. And then there's a House and Senate repealer that are the same. And it repeals the portion of the existing process to make a manufactured home an improvement to real property. So the new process for affixing a home to real property, would repeal the existing statute in that section. And that is everything.
And I have a note that the Senate fiscal analyst would like to go over language in the Senate's appropriation article. Would this be a good time to do that, Mr. Mueller?
Sure. I'll jump back to, thank you, Madam Chair. Jump back to page R, let me see, it would be R2 on the Senate side. The first item I'll just point out is on line 2.24. On the Senate side, this is some additional language in the rider for the challenge program. And the language on the Senate side just says that any of the amount that was allocated above the $1.208 million per year for the American Indian housing projects shall not be considered in the 50-50 split for the rest of the money. That goes out on the challenge program. The next item I'll jump to is on page R5 of the side-by-side. And this is when we went through the spreadsheet where I noted under the homeownership education counseling and training program, the Senate added new language on line 6.15. This would allocate $500,000 per year of the HECAT appropriation for grants for organizations that will prioritize reducing the housing disparity gap. And the next page under the capacity building grants, there's just a language difference. The Senate just includes the word nonprofit for the organizations that can apply for the capacity grants. And then also on line 6.31, I noted on the spreadsheet where the Senate has an additional carve out for the open access program. The next item I will point out is on page R8. The Senate has some new language, especially dealing with federal funds. And on subdivision 16, starting on line 7.1, the Senate lists a number of programs that where they have the Housing Finance Agency first use federal money instead of the general fund money, when it works out for some of these programs. Paragraph A, starting on line 7.2, is for homelessness programs. And basically this language says first use federal money when available for the homeless programs before using the state money. Paragraph B, starting on line 7.9, is similar language, and this is for housing counseling programs. And then paragraph C is for rental assistance. And then on paragraph D, starting on line 7.20, this is where it says any of the unused state appropriations under these first three paragraphs shall be due to use of federal funds first, should be used, transferred to the workforce home ownership program. Line 7.29, subdivision 17, is a prohibition of grant funds for hiring a lobbyist. And then subdivision 18 on line 8.1 This is the where I mentioned going through the spreadsheet that where the Senate has some additional language allocating $250,000 per year to the Bridges program, where it's allowed under federal law. Section 3, starting on line 8.16, this just directs MMB and the Housing Finance Agency to not use any of the new homeownership assistance fund from the federal programs, which is about $128.7 million. There's a provision in that federal law that allows them to backfill previous homeownership programs under COVID. And this just says, do not do that. Make sure all this new federal money is used for new programs and not to backfill any of the previous programs, specifically the $100 million of coronavirus relief fund that was allocated out earlier in 2020. Section 4 is a requirement that the Housing Finance Agency allocate at least 25% of the Pool 3 resources for workforce home ownership programs, or the workforce home ownership program, or the manufactured home park program. And it further specifies that this 25% allocation shall not be used for loans or other financing programs, and that they shall prioritize allocations under this 25% set aside for programs that will address the housing disparity gap. And then there's some language requiring a report of how this 25% of the Pool 3 is distributed. Then paragraph C on line 9.9 just says that nothing in this 25% allocation shall impair the obligation of the agency to meet its funding requirements. So those are the only items I had under Article 1, and I'll stand for any questions.
Mr. Savory, did you have anything to add?
Madam Chair, no, nothing to add to that portion.
Okay. Have we finished all the, I think we've finished all the walkthrough. I don't see any hands. Mr. Worth, am I missing anyone?
Madam Chair, there are no hands up.
And I should say, members, there are there's amazing information in the attachments. There's just a lot of good information there. I spent some time last night going through that, so I'm hoping that everyone has an opportunity to read that as well. In addition to the testimony that we'll hear, there's just a good bit of opinion from around the state. So I think if we're finished with this, thank you to all the staff for that good work. And we'll now move to public testimony. Obviously we have many testifiers, so we've asked testifiers to watch their time limits. We're going to start with the Commissioner Jennifer Ho from Minnesota Housing. Welcome.
Chair Houseman and members of the Conference Committee, my name is Jennifer Ho, and I have the pleasure of being the Commissioner of Minnesota Housing. I am going to try to model brevity this morning. thank you for the opportunity to speak today, though. And I'm not going to repeat things. I sent a letter over to the committee last night that kind of goes into detail with just some of the agency concerns. I just want to start by saying how grateful I am for the work that has been done by members of this committee and your staff over the past few months. While being a part, you know, continues to create some logistical challenges for all of us, I still feel like we were able to have substantive conversations that involve a broad array of stakeholders today notwithstanding. We see this reflected in many of the items that appear in the omnibus bills before us. I also want to mention how appreciative I am that the work has been about finding solutions rather than just admiring the problems. Also reflected in the bills before us are different visions for how to achieve what I feel are many of the same goals. While we differ in our approaches, I am hopeful on the path forward to an agreement. The governor started this session with a budget request for an additional $18.5 million in new housing resources to provide increased housing stability, to build more housing, preserve the homes we have, and support home ownership, as well as an additional $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds. These investments accompany a number of policy proposals to address needs of families and communities. My main priorities as we head into the final weeks of session are a safe and effective ending to the eviction moratorium. I'm glad for the broad recognition of the need to do this in a way that minimizes disruption for renters, owners, the courts, and the marketplace. This is also good timing with the launch of renthelpmn.org. I think the bills before us provide a good opportunity to reach an agreement quickly. an additional $100 million in housing infrastructure bonds. These flexible resources meet an array of housing needs and allow us to say yes to more projects that are ready. Increased resources for housing programs that are not getting federal COVID funding. The pandemic's impact on the housing market has only sped up and intensified the housing challenges that we face and the need to respond with more faster. And then the renter stability provisions, including 14-day notice, clarifying source of income discrimination protections, and strengthening evictions expungement. The economic impact of the pandemic has been disproportionately felt by low and moderate income renter households who are already more likely to be cost burdened by their housing. As the economy continues to recover, we cannot create further and often lasting obstacles for these households as they get back on their feet. So I just, again, want to say thank you for our time together during this session. And I look forward to the final weeks as we work toward a compromise that can help us go big so Minnesotans can go home. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I did read your letter last night. It was very clear in terms of its analysis of the bills. Thank you. And now we are joined by Chad Adams from the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership. I believe there he is. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Morning, Chair Hoffman, Chair Dreheim, members of the conference committee. My name is Chad Adams. I'm the CEO of the Southwest Minnesota Housing Partnership, and I also serve as co-chair of the Homes for All Coalition. As you've heard over the past few months, Minnesota has faced an affordable housing crisis for a while now, but during the past year, the COVID-19 pandemic only increased housing uncertainty for thousands of Minnesota households. This is why Homes for All and many housing advocates have been advocating for significant investments across the continuum of affordable housing, and also policy changes to provide stability to not just Minnesota households, but communities across the state. As the conference committee considers funding and policy for inclusion in a final package, we ask the committee to fund programmatic increases without making cuts to other programs that are equally as vital to supporting the continuum of affordable housing. Enact game-changing permanent legislation aimed at protecting rights and advancing equity for Minnesota renters. This includes policy changes to not only better meet the needs of renters, but also stabilize thousands of renter households by reforming the evictions process. To support funding increases that can make a difference along the entire continuum of affordable housing, including establishing an official task force to examine how to make our shelter system more dignified, support for the Bridges program to help with transitional housing for people with serious mental illness, and development funding to build and preserve affordable housing and especially home ownership investments for BIPOC households. Lastly, we ask that you consider the eviction moratorium off-ramp separate from the omnibus policy and funding bill. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today, and we look forward to working with the Senate and House throughout the remainder of the session. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I am told, by the way, that by Friday, our leaders hopefully will have arrived at targets for each of the conference committees. So everyone on this call, focus on the leaders between now and Friday to do the things Mr. Adams just outlined. We need a target that's healthy. So everyone needs to help us with a message to leadership before they make their decisions on Friday. Thank you, Mr. Adams. And now we're joined by Alan Arthur from AON. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Hausman, conference committee members. I first want to thank you for reminding me the tremendous detail that's required to make fine sausage. I appreciate that. Secondly, I'm here to speak about funding for NOAA, naturally occurring affordable housing, that we're losing at a rate three times every year than we're reproducing affordable housing. Senator Dreheim constantly reminds us that production is important, but so is the saving, not the losing it out the back end, which is extremely important as well. There's really a couple things to remember about why saving NOAA housing is important. Number one, it's happening at a faster rate than we're making it. And number two, it's half the cost of creating new affordable housing. So I know you all understand the crisis that has been talked about by many around the affordable housing world and for our families and our individuals who are losing their homes by economic eviction every week, every month, and throughout the year. And thank you for your support of these housing programs and the funding and the changes that are necessary to keep our people in homes. Have a great day.
Thank you, Mr. Arthur. And I can tell you that I have used that line that if we can find and save naturally occurring affordable housing, it is half the cost of building new. And that keeps that level of housing affordable to so many others. So thank you for that information. Elizabeth Glidden from the Minnesota Housing Partnership, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Hausman, Chair Dreheim, and members of the conference committee. My name is Elizabeth Glidden. I am the Deputy Executive Director of the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and here I'm here to speak about local housing trust funds, the state match. Minnesota Housing Partnership has been working with communities across the state on local housing trust funds for many years. As a refresher, local housing trust funds are funds established by local government, which dedicate local revenues for housing purposes. In a recent survey, we have identified over 30 communities that have expressed an interest in establishing a local housing trust fund. And also have identified that communities that have established local housing trust funds have increased in just 3 years from 3 to 13. And we continue to hear reports from others of establishing these funds. Local housing trust funds have stimulated innovation and are flexible to allow local communities to address their top housing needs and priorities. They are also a proven good investment as they average a leverage amount of $6 for every $1. Cities and counties are on the front lines of responding to a very real housing crisis. We thank you for your support and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much. And we're now joined by Sue Watlock Phillips from the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. Welcome. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and conference committee members. My name is Sue Watlock Phillips, and I'm the executive director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and president of the National Coalition for the Homeless. I also experienced homelessness as a teenager in the early 1970s. I want to praise God and thank all of you for in your housing meetings in the House and the Senate, you listened to people that were experiencing homelessness and in housing crisis and that were feeling the disparities that we have in homeownership and within the homeless population and really took their suggestions and their solutions and implemented into this legislation. I'd like to briefly talk about two of the excellent bills that are part of this. MICA is honored to have supported the entire Homes for All agenda, but want to talk specifically about two pieces. The Lead Safe Home Bill has come before this conference, has come before conference committees previously. On one of the links, you have a link to a video, Tysia Fletcher, who testified by video at the House Committee. She's an African-American mom with two children. Both of her children were poisoned by lead paint. Dustin became permanently disabled. You have honored Dustin and his family by funding the Lead Safe Home Bill out of the House version of the committee. And it's also known as the Dustin Luke Shields Act. They assisted in writing this bill to help us prevent the more than 700 children that are poisoned each year by lead paint in Minnesota. The Minnesota Department of Health estimates that one out of every three of our homes in Minnesota may have lead paint in it. And the Department of Health research indicates that 84% of the children that have elevated lead in their bodies live in homes that have lead paint hazards in them. One in every 100 children in Minnesota have elevated lead levels. We need to address this. By addressing it through the bill that we brought forward, this bill will pay for itself each year if we can prevent just 10 children from becoming disabled by lead, and encourage you to look at the pieces that we put into the information that Chair Hausman was talking about earlier. You also have in the bill a task force to address the Shelter Residents Bill of Rights. This was written by people that have experienced homelessness also, and from Street Voices of Change and Freedom from the Streets and other folks have been advocating for it. This would fund a task force to bring together people who have experienced homelessness, the State Interagency Council on Homelessness providers, and others to address the concerns that people experiencing homelessness are having in our current homeless system. Right now, we don't have a standard approach to how we address homelessness across the state as far as actual expectation within each of our homeless systems. Again, thank you for listening to people experiencing homelessness and the housing crisis and acting to implement their solutions. Together with God's blessings and guidance, we will prevent and end homelessness and ensure everyone, without exception, has a safe, decent, accessible home that's affordable for them. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you.
Thank you very much. I seem to recall, as we discussed the Lead Safe bill last year, that you had a map that showed that southwestern Minnesota had perhaps the highest number of homes that were 100 years old, and the homes that are 100 years old are likely the ones that are still high in lead paint. Not remembered.
Yes, Madam Chair, and be happy to again send you the link at the Department of Health that gives both all the properties that were built prior to us banning lead in paint, and then as you mentioned, is any property that's over 50 years old is certainly at very high risk, and we have that throughout. And as I mentioned, one out of every three homes probably have lead paint in them, and we don't want any of our kids to get hurt by the lead paint or become permanently disabled because it does brain damage. Thank you.
Thanks very much. We have a substitute for our next from the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities. We have Patricia Naumann, I think, who is filling in. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment this morning. My name is Patricia Naumann, and I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. I think you're usually used to seeing Mr. Charlie Vanderardi in your committee. So I appreciate the opportunity to comment today. Metro Cities does represent the collective interests of cities in the metropolitan region at the legislature, executive branch, and Metropolitan Council. Again, thank you for the opportunity to comment this morning. I want to just touch first on the importance of the state as a partner with local governments and others in the private and nonprofit sector to address the need for important resources for housing needs. These include supports for advancing the provision of new homes to serve the growing population, supports for keeping existing homes safe and viable, and supports to provide stable housing, preservation of housing, and keeping people housed. Metro Cities does appreciate and support the investments included in the House bill for the Challenge Program, the provision of a state match for local housing trust funds, and resources for preserving existing NOAA properties. Metro Cities also supports the investments to help address homeownership disparities and resources that support home ownership in the bill. I also just want to touch briefly, Madam Chair and members, on the local roles, the roles that local officials play in housing, which are longstanding and important. They're also limited, and many of those relate to ensuring local public health and safety across the spectrum of city services that are provided, of course. To this end, local decision-making for housing needs is crucial, and Metro Cities does oppose the preemption language in the Senate bill. As we and other city officials have explained and testified over the course of the session, the density provisions in the planned unit development restrictions create what we would call a one-size-fits-all approach to local land use and zoning and planning decisions that do impede fundamental local decision-making authority that is necessary for a productive development process and partnership between developers, city officials, and residents. Metro Cities does look forward to working with the Conference Committee as the Conference Committee report is considered and finalized, and I thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ms. Naumann. And we are also joined by Daniel Lightfoot from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome. We're also hearing from many mayors around. Oh, we have a question from Senator Graheim.
Yeah, I just would like to ask the last testifier, if I could, Chair, how the Senate provisions affect the safety of people in the metro communities.
Ms. Naumann. Yeah.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, when I say that cities are charged with the sort of the health, safety, and welfare of the community, of speaking broadly to how what cities are responsible for in the provision of housing and certainly other city services. And that would include just the ability for cities to address the needs of the community along the way as housing decisions and developments are considered. So when the Senate language, when state legislation does create what we'd call that one size fits all approach, we become concerned that city decisions for local land use and zoning, which apply to, of course, a range of concerns, do become impeded. And so that's the concern that I think I would like to emphasize here this morning with the provisions in the Senate bill on the density and the planned unit development restrictions. It's partly when it becomes a one size fits all approach, it becomes harder for cities then to make those decisions along the way that they might need to to address any range of considerations and concerns that occur at the local level.
Follow up, Chair.
Senator Graham.
Thank you. On the zoning language, it just says encourage higher density. It doesn't specify how much or where. It just encourages the cities to do what they're supposed to be already doing. It should be part of the 10-year plan already. On the PUD, all we're doing is closing the loophole on aesthetics. So the look of a house, not of a commercial building, not of an industrial building, not of an apartment, but single family homes. So how does that affect, the one size fit all? Because the builder or the property owner can still decide to change or put restrictions in there. It's just the city cannot, because it's already against the law. If it's not in the building code, it can't be done.
I'm guessing the next speaker might have some additional information about that too. We're joined by Daniel Lightfoot from the League of Minnesota Cities. Welcome.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Dreheim, to your question. The language in the Senate bill does require that a city cannot condition certain planning and development conditions on anything that's outside of the state building code. So one of the concerns that we have is using the state building code as sort of the floor and the ceiling for some traditional authorities that cities have from a zoning perspective. So things like setbacks, building height requirements, floor area ratios, those are not
there. If I could, there's nothing in the language about that. We're just talking aesthetics. So it doesn't have anything to do with trees or setbacks. So that there's nothing in the language that would affect that.
And Madam Chair?
Well, perhaps just to your testimony first, and then we can revisit.
Sure. I can follow up with that too as well, Madam Chair. Good morning, Chair Hausman, House and Senate conferees. For the record, my name is Daniel Lightfoot with the League of Minnesota Cities, representing 835 member cities across the states. Thank you for the opportunity to provide brief comments on the House and Senate omnibus provisions. I'd also like to thank both House and Senate conferees and members of the Housing Committees for focusing on housing this session. We did submit a letter in detail, so I'll try to be brief, but wanted to highlight a few particular provisions that are important to cities. While cities are innovating and providing all of the initiatives they can with limited resources to address locally identified housing needs, we can't possibly address the vast needs across the housing continuum without state resources. We are strongly supportive of the new funding provided in the House bill for crucial existing housing grant programs, as well as new programs, which are critical if we are to address the vast affordable housing needs in our communities. More specifically, the $6 million one-time increase for the chronically oversubscribed Challenge Fund grant program couldn't come at a better time to bolster local economic development through housing development. We're also extremely pleased that the $3 million was included for Local Housing Trust Fund state match, which will provide communities the jumpstart they need to establish a housing trust fund that can be deployed in a flexible way to meet unique housing needs. Lastly, new resources for NOAA preservation will help ensure that NOAA remains available, and doing more to preserve the homes we have must also be top of mind. We appreciate the Senate increases to the Workforce Homeownership Program, as well as the Manufactured Housing Infrastructure Grants, but stress that increases to these programs should not come at a cost to others when the need is so great. Lastly, we do remain strongly opposed to the preemption language in Article 2, Section 7 and 8 of the Senate bill. This language does broadly preempt local zoning authority and either encourages or requires a one-size-fits-all approach to zoning and land use that treats every city in the state the exact same. We urge the committees to focus on solutions that empower cities to address their unique needs rather than a one-size-fits-all limitation that does not guarantee affordability. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And we're joined now by, is it Paul Ager or Eager from the Minnesota? Did I see a hand? Senator Graheim.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I appreciate this, the league's input on this work that we're trying to do. And I know I got a letter, I think, with three main things I did not care for. One is the rent control provision that we had in our bill. So I would really, if the testifier has a little more to expand on that, you know, in our bill, we closed the loophole on rent control, one of the most studied aspects of housing. So I would really like a little more detail from why they have opposed that on private property.
Mr. Lightfoot, do you want to prepare that in writing and get it to us, or do you have something to add now?
Madam Chair, Senator Draheim, Senator Draheim's correct. Our letter did include comments on that provision. Currently in statute, as Senator Draheim noted, there is an exception in the rent control statute that allows a statutory or home rule charter city from allows them to submit a ballot question to the voters to allow the city to create an ordinance that could limit or control rents in some way, shape, or form. We don't have a specific policy on rent control specifically, but view the ballot question as a fundamental local control city function. And removing that does limit the ability for a city to respond to the will of the voters and community needs. And that is the basis of our concerns with that language.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Graheim. It occurs to me that because we're hearing from so many cities, this might be on an agenda on a another conference committee, since we are hearing from quite a few people from around the state.
Sure.
So we could revisit this.
Senator Graheim. Your choice, Chair. In the aesthetic control issue, I have a hard time understanding how that would affect the city. You know, we're trying to get more affordable homes built, and the property owner or the developer would have the choice what to do or what not to do. It shouldn't affect the security or the safety of a home with what the front of the house looks like. So I'm a little confused on that. On the zoning comments that were made earlier, you know, either the cities don't have adequate zoning or there's a different issue that haven't been brought forward. But I think we can take this offline and maybe we'll have just a hearing on this. Thank you.
Thank you. We're joined now by the, is it Paul Eager or Ager from the Minnesota Realtors Association? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Eager and I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I also submitted written testimony, which addresses several issues in both bills. So this morning, I'd like to focus on the language in the Senate bill found on pages R22 and R23 that has been the subject of the last two testifiers as well. And that's the language encouraging the development of unsubsidized affordable housing and limiting regulations on residential development. Context is important. And the context for this language is the lack of housing inventory, particularly at the most affordable price points. Our local market data report for March shows a one-month supply of inventory. That's a drop of 58% from March of 2020, and well short of the 4 to 5 months of inventory that is needed for the market to be well-balanced between buyers and sellers. When supply and demand are this out of balance, prices go up. Our members see the severe lack of housing inventory firsthand every day. The frustrated buyer who lost out when one of the 20 other offers was accepted, or the first-time home buyer on a limited budget who cannot find a home in their price range, and then when they finally do, it is gone before they can even schedule a showing. Lack of housing inventory is holding the market back and posing a significant challenge to getting more Minnesotans into home ownership, and will continue to do so until creative, intelligent, market-driven responses that meet consumer demand are implemented. This is not a problem that occurred overnight, and it will not be solved overnight. However, the Senate language recognizes that the private sector can and must play a central role in solving the inventory problem. Government-imposed costs and regulations are certainly not the only barriers to addressing the lack of housing inventory and the increasing cost of homeownership, but they are part of the problem, and importantly, they are within your power to fix. We hope you'll include the Senate language on pages R22 and R23 in the conference committee report. Madam Chair and Senator Dreheim, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you very much. And now we are joined by Michael Dahl from Homeline. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Hausman, Chair Dreheim, and members of the conference committee. My name is Michael Dahl, and I'm Public Policy Director at Homeline. Homeline is a statewide nonprofit tenant advocacy organization, and we run a free and confidential tenant hotline that since 1992 has provided legal advice to over 260 Minnesota renter households throughout all 87 counties and takes over 1,000 calls per month. The issues that renters inquire about are consistent year to year and throughout the state. They call about needed repairs, evictions or threats of displacement, like notices to vacate or lease non-renewals, security deposit disagreements, questions about lease terms and provisions, fees built into leases, inquiries about when the landlord can enter their home, and dozens of other topics. While most landlords and tenants get along and disputes are usually don't end in court, it must be noted that the relationship is primarily governed by a lease, which is unfortunately often the foundation of a power imbalance. Leases are drafted by landlords and primarily protect the interests of landlords, and that's why state law has stepped into this relationship. Minnesota law tells tenants and landlords what their rights and responsibilities are, but the law must be updated to level the playing field. We've had many of these laws since before we were a state. Some laws have evolved, although on an infrequent basis. Major evaluations of tenant-landlord law took place decades ago before there were internet or smartphones, before anyone interested could access court records on individual tenants wherever and whenever they wish. Further, due to historic patterns of housing discrimination and segregation, tenant-landlord laws have a disproportionate impact on Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Now to the specific point for this conference committee. Regular legislative review and reform of a set of laws that impact over 620,000 Minnesota families is critically necessary after they've been neglected for so long. And it is this committee that has been appointed that task to progress important reforms that promote housing stability and address common disputes. Thank you.
Senator Duckworth, is your question to this testifier?
Madam Chair, thank you so much. Actually, it was for our previous, and I was...
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed your hand.
That's okay. If somebody else has a question for this particular testifier, I can certainly wait. My apologies.
So your question was to Mr. Ager?
Correct.
I'm assuming he's still on, so Senator Duckworth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I greatly appreciate it. Mr. Ager, I just wanted to ask you to give this conference committee maybe some additional context, if you would, and as to why we're looking at so many additional potentially creative solutions in terms of the housing situation and inventory. I think a lot of folks, when they talk with their friends, they've heard about how competitive it is, there is a shortage, et cetera, but could you just give us some context historically in terms of our state and maybe the country, just how critical of an inventory shortage we are facing in housing?
And I think from the two previous testifiers, we're likely going to revisit that at an upcoming meeting. So we just very, very briefly, Mr. Ager.
Madam Chair, Senator Duckworth, thank you for the question. Yeah, I think anybody who's picked up a newspaper or read an article online, whether it's about Minnesota and the Star Tribune, I think there were another couple of articles over the weekend, or nationally, will see that we're in a historic housing inventory shortage right now. And it's been playing out over the last couple of years, but it's been particularly onerous over the last couple of months. We're seeing just an incredibly few number of homes that are just on the market and available. And I think Senator Duckworth and members of the committee, I mean, if you are out or, and around your districts and you drive by a house that's for sale on a Saturday or Sunday, you're likely to see streets lined with cars waiting to enter open houses because the opportunities out there for buying a new home are so competitive that you're seeing multiple offer situations at just about every price point. And certainly anything under about $400,000 is extremely competitive right now. And Senator Duckworth, you'll know better than I, but I think you would attest to that at that price point, you're probably likely to see upward of 10 to 20 offers, maybe even more, and 60 showings in a weekend. And that's the kind of market we're in right now.
Thank you very much. Mr. Dahl, by the way, I didn't say thank you as you concluded your testimony. I was thinking that question was going to be for you. So thank you to Michael Dahl from Homeline. We're joined now by Larry McDonough, Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under the Law. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Larry McDonough with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. I've been an attorney for almost 40 years, representing primarily landlords and tenants, both in urban areas and rural areas around the state. I just want to encourage the committee to kind of think separately about the short-term pandemic-related measures like the off-ramp and the landlord-tenant reforms, that they're really different categories, and I think they ought to be discussed and assessed on their merits. In terms of short-term, I've presented to both the House and Senate committee and just want to remind you just a couple of points about the health and the economy. The executive order, under my analysis of medical modeling studies from around the country, has saved around 2,000 lives. The census information estimates on the economy in Minnesota as recent as March 29 estimate around a 35% unemployment rate around tenants with a raw number of over 200,000. And compare this with around 16,000 eviction cases a year statewide before the pandemic. So there's certainly a risk when things open up that we could have a year's worth of evictions in a month. In terms of the tenant reform, landlord-tenant reform bills, just a couple of thoughts on that. One, some cities are already doing some of these reforms that are in the House bill. You have the pre-eviction notice in St. Louis Park and St. Paul. You have heat minimums in many cities around the state. You have St. Paul considering rent control, which is democracy at work. And you have a number of cities looking at source of income discrimination ordinances. But the problem with that is we end up having this patchwork, which affects both landlords and tenants as they migrate around municipalities. Also, just want to note that a number of these proposals are working in other areas. The pre-eviction notice, we already have that in manufactured home parks, public and subsidized housing, even under the executive order right now. And that's something that exists in 43 states and is working just fine. The infirmity lease termination proposal is very similar to the domestic violence lease termination statute we have, and that's working fine as well. And the public housing right to counsel section here, it's very limited just to a small number of the most vulnerable tenants in public housing eviction cases where the housing authorities are represented by attorneys. And this is very similar to what we have in guardianship. I know that personally because I'm a guardian of my daughter, and having a right to counsel to her when I did that guardianship it worked just fine, and it was very, you know, useful for, you know, assisting her with her rights. So thank you very much for your interest, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Mr. McDonough. And we're joined now by David Siegel from Housing First, Minnesota. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is David Siegel. I'm the Executive Director of Housing First, Minnesota, and I'm pleased to be before the conference committee this morning. The work to reconcile these two bills comes at a time when housing is experiencing tremendous challenges nationally and even more acutely here in Minnesota. Housing First Minnesota has focused its efforts on supporting policies that will directly impact the dual crises of housing inventory and affordability. This month, the Minneapolis-St. Paul region reported its lowest inventory of for sale homes in recorded history. There is simply nowhere close to enough homes for our growing population. And worse yet, homes under $250,000 are becoming extinct in the metro, with similar price pressures being felt statewide. And since the emergence of COVID-19, the disruption in the supply chain has sent lumber and other material prices surging, which underscores our need for more options at modest price points. Regarding prospects for increasing the supply of new starter homes, our process for approving housing developments is broken. We approve almost all of our housing projects by loophole in the planned unit development process, and the PUD process has given a pathway for local governments to require luxury design and exterior upgrades, and has even led to illegal impact fees and requirements that exceed the state building code. Regrettably, this local control process is failing a growing cohort of Minnesotans that are excluded from home ownership opportunities. There is no debate that we need a PUD process for the truly unique projects that require a variance. For the majority of projects, though, we need a straightforward process with transparency and efficiency to meet the modern demand for housing, which has to include starter homes. You, as the legislature, create the framework that local governments use in their planning and management of local communities. This is the proper forum to review and balance these policies, and it's clear they need to be updated and modernized. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to address the conference committee today.
Thank you very much. We have now Mark Runner from the Manufactured and Modular Home Association of Minnesota. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mark Bruner, Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We represent the nearly 1,000 privately owned manufactured home communities in the state of Minnesota that comprise about 50,000 home sites, along with factory home builders who construct approximately 2,000 new manufactured and modular homes annually. We support and appreciate a number of the common provisions in the bill, and I'd like to thank both bodies for including those. However, due to the time constraints, I'm not going to go through those specific provisions and instead want to focus on some serious concerns that we have with the provision in the bill called Opportunity to Purchase, which is on R65. As House File 1112, this has been very controversial before the House Housing Committee, Commerce Committee, and even on the House floor with our association, Minnesota Realtors, as well as owners of manufactured home communities testifying in opposition. At its core, it eliminates fundamental property rights for 1,000 of Minnesota's largest providers of non-subsidized affordable workforce housing. Minnesota is already recognized as one of the top states in the nation in providing residents of manufactured home communities with an opportunity to purchase if a community is offered for sale, or if it were to potentially close for redevelopment, with a statutory right of first refusal, exceeding resident protections in states such as Florida, Arizona, and California, all of which have a larger percentage of their residents in terms of the overall population living in a manufactured home community. Minnesota requires currently a statutory notice of sale be provided by the owner of the community if they're selling and advertising in a publication or listing with a real estate broker. Current law has worked well and allowed for the conversion of several privately owned manufactured home communities to cooperative ownership. Residents, like other buyers, already have the ability to make an unsolicited offer to purchase a community and have successfully demonstrated they're capable of doing this. Essentially, the bill takes away, or the provision, a fundamental real estate property right to grant a first option to purchase to a buyer, resulting in a significant loss of income to owners of communities. It takes away the property right of a community owner to bundle multiple properties that they might own, or ancillary businesses such as a sales center or mini storage. And it also takes away the right to sell without first giving 60-day notice to all of the residents in a manufactured home community, along with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. And that includes, essentially under the definition, minor children receiving a copy by certified mail stating the price, terms, and conditions of an offer to sell or lease a manufactured home community. It requires disclosing personal or financial information about a seller that otherwise would never be disclosed by a real estate broker. And if they manufactured home community under this provision, after giving the 60-day notice, decides that they are not going to sell to the resident organization, it adds another 31 days to the process of being able to sell their property, which now has them up to 91 days in a delay. And then there's even no guarantee or assurance that they wouldn't be challenged in court for perhaps having violated one of the notice provisions. In a sense, so you're gonna have buyers walking away from potentially the sale of a community. And in these cases, the community is not closing. It's gonna be continued to operate as a manufactured home community. And currently, resident organizations can make an offer to purchase the community. And really all this does is essentially, you know, steer current owners to investing less in upgrades in their property, perhaps investing in manufactured home communities in surrounding states. And considering that this bill, and we appreciate the inclusion of, you know, millions of dollars to continue upgrading infrastructure in manufactured home parks, as well as assist with rehabilitation and even purchasing and upgrading homes, you know, this provision really runs counter to everything else in the bill. And we think that it'd be a much better bill relative to manufactured homes without the provision, which I know isn't a part of the Senate's language. And the reason I went through this is they really haven't had a chance to hear our concerns since it wasn't heard in the Senate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And now we are joined by Greta Gates from the Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Houseman and members of the committee. My name is Greta Gates, and I am the Policy and Advocacy Manager at Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity. I am testifying today on behalf of both Twin Cities Habitat and the Minnesota Homeownership Center, and we are particularly thankful for the committee's attention to the cap amount for the rehab loan program, funding for the Homeownership Education, Counseling, and Training, or HECAP program, and funding for the Challenge program. First, we are so grateful that increasing the cap amount for the rehab loan program is a shared priority. And I wanted to say a special thank you to our author, Senator Duckworth, and Representative Agbaje for your work on this bill. We do prefer the Senate position of an increase to $40,000. We believe that this level is needed to provide extremely low-income homeowners with the resources that they need to make critical home repairs. Next, we are again grateful that HECAT is another shared priority. We know this program provides important services to prepare families for successful homeownership, and we know there is increased need for counseling and foreclosure prevention services coming out of the pandemic. We are grateful that both bodies have increased investment to HECAT, and we hope to see investments for homeownership preparation across the board. And lastly, we applaud the House for increasing investments to the Challenge program. Challenge is an effective funding source that produces and preserves affordable housing units, meeting local needs across the state. And we're grateful for further investments to the program on the House side. The Rehab Loan Program, HECAT, and Challenge represent key opportunities to invest in affordable homeownership. Along with our coalition partners in Homeownership Minnesota, we fully support efforts to create and preserve affordable homes and prepare more families for homeownership. Thank you so much for your attention to these priorities.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I should explain, members, I am pressing a little bit. The Senate goes into session at 11, so that's why I'm moving rather quickly, but appreciate all the testimony we're hearing. Now we have Sam Parmaker from the Minnesota Student Association. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Chair Houseman, and good morning, Chair Houseman, Chair Dreheim, and members of the committee. My name is Sam Parmakar, and I'm the State Government Director for the Minnesota Student Association, the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm here today to ask you to support two policy provisions from the House version of the omnibus, Article 6, Sections 7 and 10, which provide some basic tenant protections to student renters. I've submitted a more detailed written testimony, so in the interest of time, I won't go into too much depth here. Article 6, Section 7 requires rent to be prorated for short end leases that require a tenant to move out before the last day of the month. And Article 6, Section 10 says that a tenant may not be required to renew a lease of 10 months or longer until at least 4 months have passed since the date of occupation. These are two common sense reforms that would protect students from unfair leasing practices in college rental markets. Now, these aren't just issues we see in Senator Dietzick's district or the Twin Cities, but on campuses across the state, from Duluth to St. Cloud to Winona and beyond. Additionally, this language curtails some of the anti-competitive practices used by large national rental companies, which helps local landlords better compete in the college rental. In constructing this language, we worked carefully to balance the needs of student renters and housing providers. These two provisions are bipartisan and were unanimously supported by the House Housing Committee. They were written with input from housing attorneys and are not among the policy provisions opposed by Minnesota Multi-Housing. But I want to give you an example of how these provisions would impact students from my own personal experience. Back in my sophomore year at the apartment I rented, I was required to move out on August 12th, even though I had started the lease on September 1st. But I still had to pay a full month's rent. If my rent had been required to be prorated for that month, it would have saved me about $400, which is certainly not pocket change. My junior year, the apartment I lived in, the rental company told me that if I wanted to renew my lease, I needed to do so by October 31st. Again, I had just moved in on September 1st. I was considering studying abroad at the time before the pandemic, and this put a lot of pressure on me and made it really difficult to plan for my future as I was kind of panicking about the need to renew my apartment really quickly. So I do think that these protections would have a really positive impact on students across the state. And I just want to leave you with a closing thought that one thing I see over and over in my role is that young people across the state from all political persuasions are feeling more and more like government doesn't work for them. A lot of my peers have lost faith in the political process because they don't see elected officials addressing many of the problems that we as young people face. I think this committee has a really unique opportunity to change that narrative today. You can show us that you're attentive to the issues that we face and that when we participate in the civic process, we can get solutions. So please protect student renters by adopting Article 6, Sections 7 and 10. Thank you so much, Chair Hausman and Representative Tice, for including this in your bill. And thank you all very much for your time today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We're joined now by Kathy Wetzel-Mastell. Have I pronounced that correctly? Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Perfect, thanks. Yes, Kathy Wetzel-Mastell. I am the executive director of PRG, but I'm here today representing the 17 organizations that make up the Homeownership Minnesota Coalition. HOME is focused on increasing the supply of affordable ownership opportunities and narrowing the state's large racial homeownership gap. I want to thank members of the committee for all of their work to further affordable housing across the state, and I want to take this opportunity to point out that we've got nearly 30,000 households currently income qualified for homeownership who are occupying rental units that are affordable at less than 30% AMI, some of the highest demand housing and most expensive to create in the state. In addition, there are 60,000 BIPOC households that are similarly income qualified for home ownership, yet continue to rent at all affordability levels. Currently, the state supports the production of less than 100 ownership units per year. So I would say, given the testimony we've heard today, that now is the time to step up on ownership unit production and begin addressing the inventory issue, particularly for lower income and BIPOC households. Just in the last month, PRG sold two homes, both to BIPOC buyers. Unfortunately, for each of those homes sold, we had to say no to 8 to 10 other BIPOC qualified households. And those folks did lots of work to get ready for ownership, repairing credit, increasing savings, working on income stability. With increased funding for ownership production, the members of HOME are poised to narrow the racial ownership gap, address the challenges with affordable housing in greater Minnesota, and free up some of the state's most affordable rental units. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And now we have Victoria Clark, North Country Cooperative Foundation. Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hausman and members of the conference committee, and thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of some of the manufactured housing related provisions in the bill. Again, my name is Victoria Clark. I'm executive director at North Country Cooperative Foundation, which is a nonprofit housing developer based in Minneapolis. We specialize in the development and support of affordable housing cooperatives. Our manufactured home community co-op program has helped permanently preserve over 750 units of manufactured home communities across Minnesota. I'd like to express my gratitude for the commitment each of you have shown for the preservation of manufactured home communities throughout this legislative session. As a result of your leadership, the legislature is poised to make historic investments in preserving and improving manufactured home communities this year. Minnesota needs every bit of the investment that's going to be made if we are going to turn the tide of community closures and keep these communities affordable in the long term. With your help, NCF and our partners can increase the pace of preservation and keep these communities affordable to the 180,000 Minnesotans that call them home. We hope the committee carries forward its commitment to manufactured housing in the final housing bill, including increasing appropriations to the Manufactured Housing Infrastructure Fund and the Workforce Homeownership Fund. NCF is on pace to assist our client co-ops to complete over $3 million in infrastructure investments and projects in this year alone. The appropriations allocated into these funds will go to work quickly to improve the health and safety of manufactured homeowners across the state. We also hope the final bill will include allowing manufactured homeowners who live in cooperatives or nonprofit-owned manufactured home communities to title their homes as real property, which will allow them to access more affordable home financing options. We also hope included in the final bill will be the expansion of the rehab loan program, which includes the replacement of manufactured homes as an eligible use, in addition to making loans to existing homes for rehab. We also hope that the committee will carry forward its commitment to expanding the agency's Pool 3 resources and utilizing 100% of those Pool 3 resources for home ownership activities, with at least 17% for ownership production and preservation. Please continue to call on North Country Cooperative Foundation as a resource as the committee works together in the coming weeks to craft the final bill. Thank you for your leadership and your commitment to affordable home ownership.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And finally, we are joined by Dave Anderson, All Parks Alliance for Change. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hausman, Chair Dreheim, and members of the committee. My name is Dave Anderson. I'm Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, which is a statewide association representing Minnesota's 180,000 manufactured home park residents. I want to thank you for supporting manufactured housing in a number of ways, but I hope to speak with you specifically about the resident opportunity to purchase. It's a very simple proposal, but it's one that's very important to the residents. It requires a park owner provide notice to homeowners of a potential sale. It replaces a current notice requirement that only applies if a park is officially listed for sale with a real estate broker or through public advertising, and these kinds of formal listings rarely happen. I do want to cover what the proposal does not do. It does not require the park owner to sell the land to the residents or to lower their price. It does not prevent the park owner from seeking other offers or selling multiple park communities at the same time. In fact, there have been multi-park sales to residents under policies like this in other states. It simply provides residents an opportunity to make an offer. The park owner still has the exclusive right to determine what properties they want to sell and who they want to sell them to. However, without residents receiving notice, parks in Minnesota are being rapidly gobbled up by out-of-state buyers. In the last 5 years, 18% of manufactured home park lots have changed hands and 55% of those sales have been to out-of-state buyers. In fact, last year, 70% of the sales were to out-of-state buyers. And who owns these communities has a direct and powerful impact. 10 out of the 10 parks with the highest lot rents in the Twin Cities are owned by out-of-state buyers. On the other hand, as the editorials you received copies of from the Star Tribune and Mankato Free Press point out, residents have greatly improved the communities that they own, replacing roads, upgrading water and sewer systems, building storm shelters, and adding playgrounds, among other things, while keeping rent increases to as little as $6. This notice requirement has worked smoothly, quickly, and without conflict in at least six other states, including New Hampshire, which has had it for over 30 years. And I urge your support. Thank you for supporting manufactured housing, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. That was helpful. I was needed to be reminded, 55% of the sales, the recent sales, have gone to those who live out of state. So that was a helpful bit of information. We managed to accomplish all of it before the Senate has to leave us, but we even have some time for questions if members have any additional questions they'd like to ask. I don't see any hands right now. Mr. Wirth, am I missing anyone?
Madam Chair, you are not. I don't see any hands.
Senator Dreheim, any concluding comments for you or any plans for the rest of the week from your perspective?
I think there is a hand up.
Yes, I do. Representative Tice.
Yeah, I was waiting till the last minute. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just recently when Sam Farmaker was talking, he, you know, referenced again the prorating. But I know in statute, in 504B.146, it talks about lease duration notice, and it talks about prorating. The rent is prorated then, and if it's other than what they had signed the lease for. So is this just not being enforced, or do we know why that's being, I always thought we had to prorate, so I don't always get that. And Sam, I'm sorry if I butchered your name. Thank you.
Mr. Parmaker, do you have a...
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And you actually did get the pronunciation correct, Representative Tice. So I actually will try to go back and take a look at that statute. I mean, I know this is a piece of legislation we've been working on for the past 2 years. And as far as I'm aware from legislative research staff or any of the housing attorneys we've consulted, I have not been made aware of any state statute that requires rent to be prorated. I know that the legislature did pass a bill in 2019 that required, it said that if a rental company or landlord were going to enter into a short end lease, that had to be, displayed on the first page of the rent, and they had to say how much they were going to prorate the rent if they chose to prorate it. But I am not aware of any state statute that requires rent to be prorated already.
Okay, we'll do some further checking on that, Representative.
Thank you. I really would appreciate it. I hate that people are getting probably paying for stuff they shouldn't be in the first place. Mm-hmm. But as a housing provider, I know that we've been doing this.
So we'll do some checking on that.
Thank you,
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious on, again, and maybe you and Senator Graham will talk about this after, what's the what's the next step in the process and what we think the plan is going to be for tomorrow and later in the week?
Well, all I know is that Senator Graham is getting his second vaccination shot tomorrow. I'm announcing this to the world. So you're going to be in Mankato tomorrow. We have the 9 to 12 slot reserved for us. Unfortunately, it conflicts with Senator, who is Senator Pratt. So we'll have to see how that works. I hold the gavel Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Senator Dreheim holds it Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. Is that your understanding, Senator Dreheim?
Joe, we have other. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday. It's correct.
Okay, and at this point, do you have any plan for tomorrow, or we?
No, I don't anticipate anything for tomorrow. Especially since we're so close to getting our revised targets. I think work would move a lot faster once we have that.
And Senator Graham, was that your understanding too, that they were hoping to have the targets by Friday?
Yes, but who knows around here? Yes.
I know. I'm not terribly hopeful. Senator Dietzick, further questions? Mr. Wirth, am I missing anybody? Well, what you've heard today from all the testifiers is there's an entire housing continuum. And so our challenge is to address the needs across that entire continuum in order to solve problems, so many different types of problems. And I think that will be the challenge before us. Any other comments? I'm needing to mute my other phone, I think. So the next meeting of the conference committee will be at the call of the chair. Any further concluding comments from you, Senator Draheim?
No, thank you. Thank you, Chair. I think we're good.
Okay. There being no other business before us, we are adjourned.